Accession number 29566, Reel 2.
Let's buy to Reel 2. During the war, were you aware of sort of, I'm thinking of things like war weeks and activities like that where people would collect for aircraft or tanks?
Yeah, they had various collections going on. One collection they used to, well, no, there were a couple actually that I do remember quite vividly. All garden railings they used to ask permission if they could take away. These were all melted down for metal, and they used to have Spitfire weeks where they used to collect anything that was aluminium, old pots and pans, and they said these implements are going to make a Spitfire. So that was quite exciting, really, to think that, you know, one of your pots and pans might be end up as a part of a wing of a Spitfire. So it's quite fun, really.
Aside from the bombing, was there any major sort of events that took place in the war that stand out in your mind that you were aware of?
Well, I was I joined the Cubs then, and although meetings had to be curtailed quite often, we did do quite a lot of work. We used to collect waste paper, because there was a great movement of collecting waste paper for pulping down, and I don't know what they did with it, but they told us it was going towards the war effort. And then I progressed from the Cubs to the Scouts, and in actual fact, we used, anybody that had a cycle, we used to take messages from one ARP post to another ARP post. We were given a tin hat, and you had your uniform on, and you used to cycle like mad. Normally this took place when there wasn't a raid on, but I have known cases for lads to actually go from ARP post to ARP post while a raid was actually in progress. But we all got a badge which we used to wear above our right breast pocket. It was an oblong red badge, and in gold it had a gold crown in the middle and the letters NS, which was National Service, which every scout and guide got if they helped in some shape or form during the war. So, you know, if you ever see, I don't know if you will see them now, but some of the old scout uniforms you will see on just above the right breast pocket, an oblong red badge, which was a sort of a thank you, I suppose, from the government to all young people of scouting and guiding age who did a little bit during the war.
What type of messages would you carry?
Oh, you would carry messages about if there was a fire had broken out somewhere, because quite often lines were down and police and ambulance people couldn't get through because they didn't know where things were. So you'd carry all sorts of messages. It could be perhaps one case that springs to mind where the back of a, situated around various parts of the country, used to be large water tanks called EWS tanks, which was emergency water supply, which were for the fire brigade if either a hydrant couldn't be accessed or had been damaged. They used to use the EWS tank, which were used to carry thousands of gallons of water. I remember once the back of one of these was blown out by a bomb, and we had to get a message to the police to evacuate all the houses. And there was no other way of getting the message through, so a scout jumped on his bike and whizzed down to the local police station or the local fire brigade and got them out, and they started pumping out the houses and shelters. And that's the sort of thing that he used to do.
And during the early part of the Blitz, what would you say public morale was like?
It was varied. in a lot of cases, it was they can throw anything at us they like and we won't give in. But I think a lot of mothers were very, very desperate. They didn't really know which way to turn. Evacuation was always a sore point with some families. Some wanted their kids with them to stay, you know. Others wanted to get the kids out of town. But it was apprehension, I think. You know, where was... the thing was, you couldn't do anything. You just had to sit there and take it, virtually. There was no questions. You couldn't fight back. You weren't in a position to fight back.
And it's often said that there was a sort of oneness about the population during that
period. Oh, yeah, yeah. Everybody... I've never known such a period in my lifetime where everybody pulled the same way. There was no question. We were all willing the government to do the right thing, and we were all pulling the same way. Everybody helped everybody out. I can't ever, as I say, remember a time. It's certainly never been like it since. It's all me now. But then it was, you know, you helped out anybody and everybody. It was a fantastic feeling. Everybody was pulling the same way.
And given the location where you were you aware of the preparations for D-Day?
The first preparations we were aware of, we saw lots of aircraft flying over, and they had these black and white stripes on the underside of the wings. And being inquisitive kids, we tried to find out what this was, and apparently this was in preparation for the invasion of France. And all aircraft were marked in this way, so that they were known from below, particularly by our troops and the American troops, that this was the big day, you know, when we were going to stick one on Jerry, as it were.
And not long after that, the V1s started. Do you have any memories of the V1s?
Oh, the V1s, yeah, they were known as the Buzz Bomb. They were quite an ingenious effort. It was a pilotless aircraft, rocket driven, had a sound of all of its own. They were usually fired from bases in deep France or Belgium, and they came over initially in the odd one or two. I remember one night we were in the shelter and we heard this peculiar noise, and my father said, "That's not an ordinary aircraft, that's something different." And when he looked out, all he could see was a spurt of fire coming from what appeared to be the tail of this thing, but in the dark he couldn't really see. But the next day they started coming over a few more at a time, and then in the end they were sending them over, you know, dozens at a time. And as I say, the sound was something all of its own. It was a sort of a rude word? It was a sort of a farting sound. This jet engine used to sort of and when the engine cut out, it could either go on for miles or it could just drop instantly, and the nose cone was just full of explosive, and they were quite deadly. But you know, if you saw the thing coming, you ran like hell. I remember once we were on my father had an allotment, and we were all on the allotment, and one of these things, the warning had gone. And this was in the sort of latter stages of the war, when the V1s were coming over in in numbers. One, they were coming all across the where the allotment was, and one of them seemed to be coming straight for us. And lo and behold, the engine cut out. So what did we do? We just dived. And luckily for us, but unluckily for somebody else, this thing just veered to the right and it hit a row of shops further up. But they were very nasty things. After the V1, Gerry decided to use his ultimate weapon, as he put it, which was the V2 rocket. Now, this was an awful thing. In fact, it went so fast you couldn't even see the damn thing. All you heard was a whoosh, and that was it. You know, it was there. It was an enormous thing by standards of those days, but I mean, it's dwarfed now by the things that they used to send to the moon. But ironically, the bloke that made the rockets that went to the moon was the same bloke that made the V2 rocket.
Did any drop near you in
V1's, the flying bomb, I suppose the nearest was 200 or 300 yards away, but we and the rocket, we had one V2 rocket which was a couple of miles away.
Do you have any memories of the celebrations at the end of the war?
Yes, only we heard them on the radio. That time there was very little television, or no television really. But we were told about them on the radio, and also if you went to the pictures, you saw them on the newsreel. Plenty of troops and civilians in London milling around, singing and dancing, and outside Buckingham Palace. And subsequently, you know, when you saw the newsreel, you saw the royal family and Winston Churchill and all the members of the government waving to the crowds. And I remember Churchill's favourite line, where he said, "This is your victory," and it was quite some celebration, really. And I think the trouble was that people expected life to change overnight, which it didn't. I mean, rationing went on for at least another 4 or 5 years, and really nothing seemed to get any better.
Were there any local celebrations?
We had street parties, the local street parties. All the mums got together. Streets were blocked off unlawfully, I may add. But the police turned a blind eye, didn't say anything. And each street seemed to have its own street party. Where they got all the chairs and tables from, God only knows. In fact, where they got all the rations from, I don't know. But there was tons and tons of food, sandwiches, jellies, tea, pop, lemonade, you name it. I think the black market must have done a roaring trade for victory celebrations, because the kids certainly had a wonderful time.
And was there a sense of relief amongst the population?
Yeah, I think the sense of relief came from the fact that mums knew that there wouldn't be any bombs falling. Kids, I'm not so sure about. It was a bit anti-climax. There was no more shrapnel to collect. It was, as earlier I said, that, you know, you tended to be a bit frightened, but for a kid it was quite an exciting time, and it was there was no more of this to look forward to.
And you said you left school at 14 to
I
go
left
to work.
At 14, yeah. With no qualifications. I did sit the 11 plus, but at that time we had 54 in the class. The teachers, again, were men mainly in their late 50s, who'd probably had a lifetime of teaching and were looking forward to retirement. Did I really want to teach a class of 54 who didn't want to learn anyway, always playing about, skylarking. So really, they weren't really interested in us, to be quite honest. And I think out of 54, we had one that actually passed 11 plus. All the rest, complete and utter duffers. Or at least that's what we were led to believe, because when the chap came along to the school from the local labour exchange to interview you, and one of the parents was requested to be in attendance at the same time, we were told as much. Your child will never get a job because da-da-da-da-da, you know, they've never bothered at school, so what chance have they got outside? I mean, I was mad on sport. I was very good at football. And my father, actually, who, as a youngster, had been on Arsenal's books and finished up with Leighton Orient, asked me if he wanted me to... he asked me if he wanted me, him, to go along to West Ham United and see if they could put me on the ground staff. But for some unknown reason, I declined the offer. He said, well, think about it, because football clubs now, usually, if you don't make the grade, they will give you a trade anyway. They, you know, put you through a trade. But I don't know what it was. I just didn't fancy the idea, although I was mad keen on football. And, you know, I'd always played for the school. I didn't take the offer up, which sometimes I regret, although afterwards when I left school and I joined the firm that I was to work for until I went in the services, I'd played for them and I was spotted. And I was given a semi-pro contract for the county side. But I left school and with really no idea what I wanted to do or where I was going. I went along to the local labour exchange and I looked down the list and lo and behold there was a local paint firm in the Barking area, which was only about 25 minutes from us on a push bike, and they wanted a laboratory assistant. So I went along and applied, had an interview, and lo and behold, I got the job. It paid 17 and 6 a week, and as much washing up of chemical flasks and apparatus that you could wish for, in white spirit and all sorts of manner of horrible stinky things I had to clean out, and used to fetch and carry and run around for every Tom, Dick and Harry. You know, you were the lowest of the low. But I stuck it and I gradually progressed.
And you were aware at that time that you would have to do national service?
Well, not really. Not really. It only hit me when I left 14, and from the age of 14 to say 17, I just enjoyed myself. I played football nearly all the time. I started playing badminton, and I became quite accomplished at that. In later years, I played for Essex County, because there was a chap at the firm who was a very good badminton player, and he took me along, and it was just something that came very natural to me, and he must have seen something there, because he took me under his wing, and I started receiving county coaching. So I was never in, really, at home. My mother used to see me at meal times, and then I was off, you know. It was either badminton or football. And at work, I was still washing up and running errands for most people. But as time went on, you know, I came off of that and got onto the bench and actually started doing some interesting work. But no, I can honestly say I wasn't really aware of people going away and doing national service. It probably hit me with about a year to go before I went in that people were being called up. I mean, I was aware that we had garrisons all over the world because, you know, at that time we were still a world power, so to speak. We had colonies that had troops in, and but there was nothing major going on, or at least nothing that I was aware of.
And how did they call you up?
Oh, that's interesting, really, because I suppose my military adventure began the day I registered at the local Labour Exchange under the National Service Act. That was in about December 1949. We just had Christmas. And about 3 weeks later, I was summoned to attend a medical. This was held in an old Nissen hut at Wanstead, if I remember. And this Nissen hut was divided down the middle with a screen. On one side you had RAF medical officers, on the other side Army medical officers. And at the time I had a preference for the RAF. I think because I thought the uniform was nicer, the shirts were nice and smooth, and I thought, that's for me. So I had my medical, and to my astonishment, they said I was unfit for military service in the Royal Air Force. But would I go on the other side of the screen, which I did, and I had what I can only describe as the same routine examination that I'd had 10 minutes ago, and this time I was passed A1 for the Army. So, you know.
What was the medical examination?
Oh, the medical was the usual type of thing, you know, your breathing, how they weighed you, measured you. To me, it wasn't so embarrassing, but to some blokes, it was embarrassing. You were walking the full length of this hut, completely stark naked, and there were lady medical officers there as well. And there were some blokes that, you know, went as red as a beetroot. And the old business of they would have a cane, which they would lift up one testicle and say, "Cough." And then they would lift up the other testicle and say, "Cough." And we never quite found out what this was all about. We never knew why they said "cough" and what it was supposed to represent. But it was quite funny, really.
Did they check eyesight and hearing and that sort of
thing? Oh, yeah, all the other things like eyesight, hearing, if you've got any peculiarities, whether you wore glasses, whether you were deaf or, you know, had anything wrong with you, they found. And invariably most people, even if they put things on, I remember one bloke, he reckoned he'd swallowed a bar or half a bar of soap before he came in. So he came in, he was foaming at the mouth. And he told one bloke that he was mad. But they were up to all these tricks. That you can't put anything past these people. They've seen it all before. So, you know, you're flogging a dead horse, really. So you're passed. So that's it. And I didn't hear anything after that for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks, I suppose. And then in the post, I had a buff looking envelope, which was my travel warrant to go to Colchester Barracks. Now, the travel warrant is a wonderful thing because it's a one-way ticket to hell, virtually. Because you don't pay for it, you see, so you think, oh, I'm getting something for nothing. But you don't realise that that's the be-all and end-all. It's one way of the forces getting you to a certain destination and you haven't got any way back. So you pack your little case. They tell you to bring a small suitcase, preferably with your personal belongings in. You know, your shaving kit and your washing soap and all, and flannel and all that sort of thing. So I went along to, I think it was Liverpool Street Station, because that was the connection to pick up the train to Colchester. Now, I think Colchester at that time was probably the farthest I'd ever been in my life. I'd been away to camp plenty of times as a scout, but never as far as Colchester. Anyway, once I got to Liverpool Street Station, I was aware that there were lots of other young chaps all milling around, looking at one another rather blankly and not speaking, and we all seemed to make our way to the same platform. And this is in the days of steam. The carriages were divided then into compartments. You had a door which said first class, second class or third class, and we, naturally enough, were confined to the third class carriages. Anyway, all piled into these carriages and off we went. And Colchester, I can't remember really how many miles it was away from London. I suppose it must be 100 or so miles, 80, 100 miles. This journey seemed to go on forever, and the train was forever stopping and picking up civilians and oddbods with cases. And finally, we arrived at Colchester Station, and we all spilled out onto the platform, and there was nobody there. Anyway, we were all milling around again for about 10 minutes, and then a chappy in uniform with two stripes came onto the station and said, "You lot, outside." And we all threaded our way through out of the station to be confronted by about 6 3-ton lorries, army lorries, and there were more blokes out there with stripes on their arms, which we found out later were corporals and sergeants. And they said, "All right, lads, get on the trucks and we're off." So we did that. And then after a short journey, we got into Colchester Garrison, which at that time was the main centre for the East Anglian Training Brigade Infantry. And it consisted of the Essex Regiment, the Royal Norfolk Regiment, Suffolk Regiment and Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire Regiments. And that was the main training area. And they just drove into the camp and said, "All off and just wait there." We were standing there outside the guard room.